Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past the hour, Kirk Heinze hosts.
We'll learn how MSU Extension is helping farmers cope with the physical and emotional stress occasioned by tough economic times on the farm. We'll also preview the 22nd annual Quiet Water Symposium coming up on the MSU campus, and we'll learn about a visionary new program to help our veterans establish careers in the agricultural industry. And to discuss a number of green business-related topics, including the possible impact of the Trump administration, is Nathan Bomey, business reporter for USA Today.
MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR begins at 4:06. Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, he has been very, very busy of late covering the North American International Auto Show, implications for American business as we transition to the new regime in Washington, the ongoing saga of the Volkswagen settlement, a few other odds and ends, like writing a book. With us to talk about some of the environmental implications of these topics and his book is Nathan Bomey. Nathan is the business reporter for USA Today. Nathan, it's been a while, but pleasure having you back on Greening of the Great Lakes.
It's so glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
Nathan, you've been cranking out the copy, not only for USA Today, but of course you've got the book out. But you've always done that. Just for starters, the last time we talked, you were at MLive.com. Tell us a little bit about your journey to USA Today.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that question. I actually was spent a lot of time in Ann Arbor reporting on the tech community there and the entrepreneurs and the University of Michigan research that was occurring and turning into startup companies that have really helped continue to keep that Ann Arbor area economy one of the brightest sources of activity in Michigan. And then I went over to the Detroit Free Press, where I covered General Motors, and eventually ended up transitioning into covering the bankruptcy of Detroit. And then after that, just in early 2015, I had the opportunity to come over to USA Today, the headquarters here in the Washington, D.C. area. So it's been a lot of fun, and one of the nice things about being at the USA Today is that we're still able to collaborate closely with the folks at the Detroit Free Press, since we're all owned by the same company, Gannett, and so we collaborate closely. Just the other week, I was in Detroit all week, and my parents still live in Michigan. I was in Detroit, though, for the auto show, of course, and so covering a lot of the automotive industry, so it's always fun to be able to talk about those issues.
Well, a nice segue into the auto show and the auto industry. You wrote several pieces from the North American International Auto Show, but because of the focus of this program, your take on this move towards mobility and autonomous vehicles, I think in one of your columns you even quoted Bill Ford saying something about flying cars of the future.
You know, autonomous vehicles and electric vehicles are really no longer a question of if, but more a question of when. And, you know, there's some debate about how quickly we'll get to, say, fully self-driving cars where there's not even a steering wheel. That may still be a long way off, but I think that we're fairly close to a situation where you have multiple automakers selling vehicles that can do most of the activities on the road without any human intervention. So that is probably only a few years off. And whether we get to the steering wheel free car anytime soon, that's a little bit less likely, but eventually that will come as well. And then, of course, with regard to electric vehicles, I think that it's increasingly becoming clear that that will be paired with the autonomous vehicle revolution. So most of those autonomous cars will eventually be electrics. For example, Chevrolet with the Chevrolet Bolt, the North American Car of the Year named at the auto show this year. The Bolt is, in autonomous versions of it are actually being tested by Lyft, the ride-sharing company, and actually GM continues to test and tweak and refine those autonomous Chevy Bolts at its tech center in Warren, Michigan. So it's definitely coming.
Well, back in September, you did a column on a spin that you took in an Uber self-driving car. How was it?
Yeah, you know, that was fascinating. I had the chance to go to Pittsburgh and attend that event where, this is pretty rare. What I was impressed by was that they put journalists in the driver's seat of these autonomous cars, because most automakers and tech companies who are developing this technology are not yet comfortable allowing the journalist in behind the steering wheel. They usually put you in the passenger seat and then have an engineer behind the steering wheel. Here, though, they actually did allow me to go behind the wheel. And so that exposes the vehicle in some ways to the scrutiny of a journalist, of course. And so I thought it performed very well. It was, taking me through the streets of Pittsburgh, which is a notoriously difficult place to navigate, fairly smoothly, turning in front of traffic without my intervention and, stopping for pedestrians and steering around bicyclists, going across bridges, things like that. But at the same time, there were multiple situations it could not handle and then had to hand the control of the vehicle over to me, at which point I had to grab the wheel within a moment's notice. So many challenges, but I was impressed by the status of the Uber car.
Well, I can testify to the driving in Pittsburgh because I have a son-in-law from that town and I've been there many times. And you're right, it can be a nightmare up and down those mountains and through those tunnels.
Yeah, it really can. And also the weather variability is one of the factors that they wanted as well, because you see Google, for example, which does a lot of testing on the West Coast, does not experience snow there. So that's a challenge that is really significant for self-driving cars. Snow is one of the problems. And so that is something they will experience in Pittsburgh.
We're talking autonomous vehicles with Nathan Bomey, the business reporter for the USA Today. Nathan, the link between autonomous vehicles and sustainability and green driving, you mentioned electric vehicles, but the link is very strong there between more fuel efficiency, actually not even being on fuel, and the future of emissions.
Yeah, especially because when you have a ride-sharing fleet, for example, if we have a day that comes, which many experts believe will come, when ride-sharing fleets are basically a group of vehicles that drives around, town on their own or with a driver inside who kind of monitors the situation, it's almost like a taxi fleet, then it's a lot easier to plan your fueling situation than if it's a consumer who drives a vehicle and then parks in a garage or parks at home. Because what could happen is you'd understand this vehicle can go, say, in the case of the Chevrolet Bolt, 238 miles on a battery charge. And if you know you've gone 200 miles today, you can plan your charging times on a fairly regular basis. And so it makes a lot of sense to then basically make your fleet of ride-sharing vehicles electrics, because you're also, of course, going to be wanting to make a profit. And if you don't have to pay for gasoline, that could help a lot. So I do expect that many electric vehicles will end up as autonomous vehicles. And then there's another issue here, which is the trucking business, which may be one of the first industries to really experience autonomous vehicles. Whether we'll see electric trucks at some point, hard to say, but certainly autonomous vehicles will be coming to the trucking industry as well.
Nathan, you're based in Washington now. As you know, President Trump just recently met with auto leaders. Everyone's kind of playing nice in the media. And close to the vest, I might say. You know this. But with the caveat that this would be speculative on your part, what are the hopes and fears of the auto magnates when it comes to the Trump administration?
Well, it is a very interesting dance that we see occurring, because I think that there is some reservation and also some excitement on behalf of the automakers, and they won't necessarily describe it like that. But what's happening is that they are fearful of the possibility that the North American Free Trade Agreement could fall apart, because, of course, President Trump has promised to renegotiate it. And that is something that all the automakers have bet their business model on, by basically expanding pretty aggressively in Mexico. But what President Trump, of course, has said is that he believes that free trade with Mexico in particular has disadvantaged American workers. So I'm not here to necessarily make an argument about whether that's the case. But the fact is that the automakers would be disrupted substantially if somehow that fell apart. And so they want to preserve as much of that as possible while recognizing that it's likely to change in some capacity. And so then, but on the other hand, I think that they're very eager to get some breathing room on the fuel economy standards, you know, corporate average fuel economy, which is called CAFE standards, that the Obama administration negotiated with the automakers and got their agreement on pretty strict standards by 2025. I think Trump has signaled pretty clearly that he expects to loosen those in all likelihood. So if that happens, that the automakers would like that because it would allow them to make more of the big vehicles that where they earn a lot of profit. The problem, of course, is from an environmental perspective, that has a bigger carbon footprint, and ultimately we'll have to deal with that if that's what happens. So there are consequences to all these decisions, but I think what Trump's he says America first is his strategy, and I think the automakers really want to protect profits first in all capacities.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, my guest is Nathan Bomey, business reporter for USA Today. We've been talking about autonomous vehicles and their future. We've been talking about implications on the auto industry of the Trump administration. Nathan, in a general sense, as far as businesses that have been moving very strongly towards sustainability, like the Ford Motor Company, for example, like Coca-Cola, like Steelcase, like all kinds of different companies, is that movement towards more sustainable manufacturing practices and social responsibility and all that going to continue, regardless of what the Trump administration might do with respect to EPA or to the Department of Energy?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it's hard to make an overarching comment about everybody, but I think that what I'd say is that we haven't yet seen any major announcements from any major companies that have essentially canceled any sort of environmentally sustainable plans. We haven't seen anything like that. And I think that's because in many cases, it's good for business to be, to protect the environment through your business practices. For example, you know, General Motors has gone waste-free, zero waste at all of its manufacturing facilities. And I don't see any reason why they would reverse course on that. I think it's just good for business. In some cases, they actually make money off of some of the materials that they recycle and reuse. So, you know, I just don't see why they would reverse course on that. Also, and you talk to companies, there's a recruiting aspect of this type of this issue that they're looking for young talent in particular, in many cases, that actually really values sustainability and these issues. And so they find it difficult to attract people to their company, to attract the best talent in the world to the company if they're viewed as being uncaring about the environment or about sustainability. So that's a big factor, especially in an aging workforce that is going to make it increasingly difficult to get the type of people that you need. So I don't necessarily expect to see a big rollback in that type of thing, but I do think that environmentalists are legitimately concerned about the possibility of increased energy, oil pumping, and regulations like that that could eventually reverse some of the progress that may have been made on carbon emissions. So it really depends on the industry, I think.
Well, like so much with a new administration, we sort of have to wait and see as these things unfold.
Yeah, that's right, and especially with President Trump, whose campaign promises were all over the map. And, you know, I think really the proof is in the pudding on what actually happens, especially when you see statements coming out of the press secretary and that the White House that, you know, in some cases are just, you know, blatantly not true. And so it's I think we have to wait and see what actually happens to judge the policies, and the promises, you know, are cheap and it for all politicians. And so the real question is, what do they actually do?
Nathan Bomey, a business reporter for USA Today, you have written extensively about the Volkswagen settlement. And I know we could discuss this for an hour, but could you give us a quick update on the $15 billion settlement you covered back in October? Because I think $2.7 billion was for environmental mitigation, another $2 billion for clean emissions infrastructure, and maybe some of the other pending settlements. But what about the money that's been designated for environmental purposes? How is that supposed to be used?
Yeah, I don't have all the details in front of me. What I can say, though, is that I know that one of the key priorities is to help basically try to reverse the nitrogen oxide emissions that were produced in excess of U.S. standards through these Volkswagen vehicles by basically providing incentives for companies and consumers to get all the appliances out of the mix and that sort of thing. And one of the other key objectives is to bolster the use of zero emission vehicles. So Volkswagen is committing as part of this deal to produce more electric cars. And then lastly, to help improve electric charging infrastructure, which is one thing that is key to the proliferation of electric cars. If you don't have the charging units, then it's going to be less incentive to go out with an electric car. So all that taken together is intended to mitigate the impact of these vehicles that have been spewing this pollution for a decade in some cases. So that's the goal.
Nathan, for me in this, and I'll ask it to you because I've never been able to figure it out, but maybe the $64,000 question, or maybe it's a $64 million question. Why did Volkswagen expend the time, the money, and the expertise to develop this brilliant software system that essentially circumvented the emissions testing, when they could have taken the same money and just complied with the emission standards?
Yeah, and that's really you're absolutely right. That is the key question, and I don't think that we've gotten a solid answer yet. I think, however, that we have gotten some indications. One of the first explanations, I guess you could say, is that Volkswagen's top executives had put significant pressure on their engineers to meet the diesel emissions in the United States, which, to many people's surprise, are actually more strict than the diesel emissions in Europe. And so they said, you know, we need to be able to sell diesels in America because that's our core brand and that's what people know us for. But the engineers had a very difficult time meeting the U.S. standards. And so ultimately, they just decided that they couldn't meet the standards. They actually, and I think that was a big admission for Volkswagen's engineers to acknowledge, because there's a lot of pride in German engineering. And they had to acknowledge they actually could not meet the standards. And so they decided, instead of, you know, basically not selling the vehicles, that they would just install the software to essentially trick the regulators into thinking that they had met the regulations. And so that's one of the explanations. But you know, it's still, like you say, given how much the scandal has cost, I obviously think they never realized it would cost this much. But given how much it's cost, given the risks involved, you have to ask yourself why. And I think that we still haven't gotten great answers on that.
Nathan, we've got a couple more minutes. I want to get into your book a bit, Detroit Resurrected to Bankruptcy and Back. It came out last April, W.W. Norton. But tell us a little bit about the book and a couple of the key messages that you hope to convey.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, it was a big challenge and a lot of fun to work on this book, to work on the story of the biggest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. You know, Detroit is the arsenal of democracy, you know, and yet the arsenal of democracy had democracy suspended in the form of an emergency manager who led the city through bankruptcy. But ultimately, I always ask people to look at it and to ask, you know, why did we allow Detroit to get into a situation where 40% of the streetlights were out, where the police were taking half an hour to get to the scene of an emergency crime, where the bus system was completely broken and people were sometimes waiting up to an hour for the bus to come. You know, this was a humanitarian crisis. The people of Detroit were just waiting for someone to come along to actually give the city a second chance. And, you know, we're talking about $18 billion in debt. $4 out of $10 of their budget was going to debt. And this was completely unsustainable. And so when Kevin Orr, as emergency manager, came in and said that the city has to file for bankruptcy and to start putting its people before its creditors, that was the first time that Detroit finally actually started to move in the right direction with its finances. Because the goal of the bankruptcy was not to, you know, to hurt anyone in particular, but to realize that the city could no longer afford the kind of benefits it promised to its pensioners and to its creditors, its bondholders. It had to put the people first and put services first. And so that's what they did. They freed up enough money to start reinvesting in police and fire and blight demolition and buses and things like that, basic services that the people of this country deserve. And I think that they were successful in that. Was it a home run? I mean, not necessarily, because there's so many, many challenges. But they do have the breathing room now, and you see a city that has surpluses and is starting to attract some investment. Many challenges in the neighborhoods that are not going away anytime soon. But I am cautiously optimistic for Detroit's future.
Well, yeah, and again, the book is Detroit Resurrected, To Bankruptcy and Back, W.W. Norton. It's available wherever books are sold. He is Nathan Bomey. He is the business writer for USA Today. As always, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes, it's great to reconnect, and love to talk to you guys anytime.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
My next guest is a doctoral student in the Department of Entomology at Michigan State University. He's an Army veteran, and he's also a national leader in connecting veterans like himself to careers in agriculture. Adam Ingrao, it is an honor and a pleasure to welcome you to the program.
Well, thank you for having me here today.
First of all, Adam, tell us a little bit about your service after 9/11.
Yeah, so basically the way I was raised in my family is national service was always something that was very important. I'm a fourth generation Army veteran, and so when 9/11 happened, I really felt like it was my turn to serve my country. And so I enlisted in 2002, shipped the day after Christmas 2002 to Army basic training. Merry Christmas. There you go, and Happy New Year. And basically started my career in the military there. And for me, I was joining the military for life. It was I saw myself retiring from the Army. It was something that I'd really thought about and really wanted to do. But that all got upended in 2004 after I suffered a career-ending injury. So after that injury, I was basically medical discharged from the military and sent home to be cared for by the VA. And for me, that transition was really rough. I had left my unit, which was, you know, in itself, there was a lot of guilt associated with that. These were my brothers and sisters that I was serving with. And so coming home now, a disabled vet at 25 years old, was really tough to deal with. A lot of depression went along with that. And really, I found healing for myself through agriculture, really through getting outside. I couldn't walk at the time when I got out of the military, but I had a cast on my leg, but I could definitely be pulled around places. And so it came down to my parents kind of helping me out and getting me out into the yard and kind of working in the garden. And that's really where I started to see this component of healing in agriculture. And that really has shaped my life from that point on.
And then from an educational standpoint, you went to a community college for a while. Then you went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. I'm familiar with that, a wonderful university. And ever since then, your academic career has flourished.
It really has. I took advantage of my post-9/11 GI Bill. And I remember the conversations me and my wife having leading up to going back to school. And we had really decided that we wanted to kind of shift our lives to focus on agriculture. And so that's where it really came down to. I went to Crafton Hills Community College for a couple of years and then went to Cal Poly SLO. And that polytechnic education that I received from Cal Poly is something that serves me every single day here at MSU. It's where I began to understand my love for insects. Dr. David Hedrick there really became a great mentor for me and really taught me the value of insects and agricultural systems and the roles they can play in managing pests. And so that's really where it all began. It's also where I first took my first beekeeping course from Scott Jeffries. And that has really been something that has made a big difference in my life as well.
Yeah, we'll come back to the bees here in a second. You came to Michigan State to pursue your doctorate in entomology. I think in 2015, you secured a very prestigious National Science Foundation Fellowship. Where in all of this academic career advancement, where did you begin to think, you know, there's some things I can do on the side to connect veterans to agriculture?
So that really came back to the Department of Entomology here at MSU. Part of the degree requirement at the time when I started there was that we had to do this thing called an enrichment component, which was basically 9 units outside of our area of expertise. Now, some people take advantage of that to go do other areas of science, but I saw this as an opportunity for me to actually reach back out to my community, the veteran community. And so I proposed to my PhD committee that I was going to develop a statewide network for veterans to understand the value of agriculture as a potential career opportunity, not only just for the financial well-being, being able to be your own boss as a farmer, farmer or working for somebody else or, you know, an agricultural company, but also that healing component that constantly comes back to me. So it was my opportunity really to give back to my fellow veterans. And thankfully, my PhD committee saw the value in that and allowed me to pursue this. And that's really where it all began.
My guest is Adam Ingrao. He's a doctoral student in entomology at Michigan State University. He's also developed several programs to link veterans to agricultural careers. You mentioned the network. You call it Veterans in Agriculture Network through the Michigan Food and Farming Systems. How does it work?
Well, basically, it is a network. It's basically a bunch of veterans getting together and sharing resources. And so myself and my fellow Army veteran, Dylan Thomas, a great friend of mine, basically run this organization where individual veterans can get in contact with us, whether it be for just reaching out to find community or whether it be to find a job or find an educational program that may suit them in an agricultural area. We really try to find all of the resources and educational opportunities available for veterans in the state and then connect individual veterans with those resources. So it's really a case-by-case basis. I talk with veterans every single day. And some of those conversations are, you know, basically I'm looking for a program to get into. And obviously, we at Michigan State have an incredible number of programs that veterans can take advantage of in agricultural areas, not just four-year programs, but ag tech programs. So those are always things that we talk about. But then we also talk about individual workshops, like, you know, maybe NRCS is holding a workshop on applying for EQIP grants or something like that. So we facilitate those types of connections as well.
Oh, it occurs to me that, and you can verify this, but among veterans, among active duty people and among veterans, is the awareness of agriculture among those groups pretty much limited like it is among virtually all groups in the United States?
Absolutely. We still run into that same issue where, you know, we need farmers, and veterans are a great component or a great group to reach out to be farmers because they have a lot of the skills necessary to be successful in farming. But even with those skill sets that are easily transferable, a lot of veterans just aren't exposed to it. Now, there are a lot of veterans that come from rural areas, and so they grew up in kind of an agricultural setting. And so
they have a sense of it.
And so the conversations that we have when it's somebody that's in that situation, it's really not that difficult to make them realize, well, hey, you know, I have a really, you know, dedication to duty, and that's something that transfers easy over into agricultural life. So those conversations are easy. But we find a lot of times, even with urban vets that are living in urban areas, that they really can see the value of it. And again, it goes back to that healing component. It's, you know, this is something that I can do maybe to make a little money off on the side, but that healing component is something that really speaks to veterans. And we understand that oftentimes being in a 9-to-5 career setting that's hustle and bustle is just doesn't fit a veteran. But a lot of veterans love being outside. They love interacting with nature. And it helps them personally and professionally.
Well, you've taken your work to a very existential level because you have your own bee farm. You call it Bee Wise Farms. And you created a Heroes to Hives program that's focused on work around your farm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so last year, my wife and I decided that it was time for us to do something on our farm to give back to veterans as well. We have the network that we work within, but I really saw that beekeeping had this opportunity to it that a lot of other agricultural careers are not so, they're not as easily attained without going through some sort of an educational program. So beekeeping is one of those areas where you don't go to school to become a beekeeper. You don't go to a four-year program to become a beekeeper. No, you actually learn from mentors. And that's how most of us in the beekeeping industry have learned, is from a mentor. My mentor was Scott Jeffries out at Cal Poly. And so these types of individuals that play roles in our lives as mentors are very valuable. That's what we saw as an opportunity for us at Bee Wise Farms. So I actually reached out to veterans in my community. We found 5 veterans that were part of our pilot program. And basically, we took those veterans through an entire season of beekeeping, all the way from starting up, thinking about, you know, where am I going to purchase bees, what types of bees am I going to purchase, all the way through harvesting honey. And that program was so successful and received such community support that it came to the point this year where we started to receive individuals that were interested in donating to us, and we realized that we needed more capacity in order to do that. Thankfully, our relationship with MSU Extension is very strong, and MSU Extension through the Michigan Pollinator Initiative actually have worked with my wife and I to transfer this over to an MSU Extension program.
For veterans or those close to veterans who are listening to this interview right now, what would you tell them about getting involved in one of your programs?
If you want to get involved in any of my programs, you can contact me directly. We have Facebook pages for both Heroes to Hives and the Vets and Ag Network, so that's one really great way to keep in connection. Or you can email me through my MSU email address, ingraoad@msu.edu.
Or they can just Google Adam Ingrao, that's Ingrao. Adam is a PhD student in entomology at Michigan State. He is a national leader in connecting veterans to careers in agriculture. Adam, continued success. It was a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, despite some of the common stereotypes about the bucolic life on the family farm, the truth is that farming, like all professions, can be exceedingly stressful, especially when the economics are challenging, like right now. Michigan State University Extension is working to help farmers understand and cope with the effects of mental and physical stress and fatigue. To tell us more, we welcome back to the program Dr. Jeff Dwyer, Director of MSU Extension, and Suzanne Pisch, an MSU Extension educator who focuses on social and emotional health and well-being. Jeff, welcome back to the program.
Kirk, thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about this very important topic.
And Suzanne, a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Yep.
Jeff, let's start with you. For our listeners who maybe have the stereotype of farming out in nature under God's sun and all that sort of thing, it can be stressful. What's going on in the agricultural community these days?
Right. Well, you're right. It can be very stressful. The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health has recently indicated that farm laborers and farm owners have the highest rates of death due to stress-related conditions. Financial stress, other mental health-related issues are, of course, common among all families in many respects, but we certainly understand that families in agriculture experience a particular kind of stress, and that's been true in Michigan. And, of course, we've become aware, especially in recent months, and Gordon Wink reached out to us from MDARD over the summer and said, you know, we're hearing more and more reports about issues associated with the financial stress that folks are experiencing in agriculture in the state of Michigan. We're hearing about more attempted suicides. We're unfortunately hearing about some completed suicides. Is there anything that you can do? And we're very fortunate that we have experts in MSU Extension like Suzanne Pisch and our other colleagues who were able to respond.
We're going to get to Suzanne in just one second, but for those who may not know the fluctuations of commodity prices, right. I mean, even when farming is and prices are good, farming can be stressful. But when commodity prices are depressed, like milk prices right now, that really creates additional stress.
Well, it really does. And you're absolutely right about the reference to dairy. I mean, they're in probably not even in the middle yet of what may well end up being a three-year span of really reduced milk prices. And that's extraordinarily difficult. And, you know, it's also difficult in the sense that the industry has changed so much, certainly dairy, but others as well. So you might say that some of the larger operators can weather changes that some of the smaller family-operated outfits have a little more difficult time with. So we are concerned, and we're really actively engaged and interested in seeing how we can better serve ag families and the ag community by, I think, bringing some of the expertise we have in other areas that they might not know so much about. And I think it's true here in that I think many of the ag families that are now benefiting from this mental health first aid training that Suzanne and others are doing right now for the reasons that we've already mentioned, maybe weren't aware that Extension even did those things previously. And so I think that's an important part of what we're doing is saying, look, we have this expertise in different areas, but how can we bring them together to really serve the needs of people and families in Michigan?
Well, speaking of engagement and expertise, Suzanne, you're on the ground working with these farm families. You're working with people who work with farm families. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about how the programs evolved in the great state of Michigan.
Well, like Dr. Dwyer said, in the summer we were kind of feeling the stress. We were noticing that things were happening throughout Michigan, and we just formed a committee, and I my expertise is in social emotional health. I have a master's in counseling, but I also have a father who's a dairy farmer, and he's a family farm. We milk about 100 cows, and he milks 365 days a year, 7 days a week. So I understand. I know it. I live a quarter of a mile from him. So I understand, and I have a passion for this. So what we started and what our first phase was is that we wanted to get as many people within MSU Extension and even other stakeholders and people that work with farmers certified in the mental health first aid. And so we did two of those classes, and 35 people came. So we have lots of MSU Extension people there, but we also had others that came and took part in that class. From that, we had contacts then that have called us, and we have went out, myself and a couple of the ag educators that have expertise, we've went out and we've done specific classes for their staff, for their people, for the people that work firsthand with farmers, and it's been great.
As you well know, for many farmers and agricultural families, it's very difficult, like any family, to talk about stress and suicide and fatigue and those sorts of things. What does your training do to encourage the farm families to seek help?
So the workshop that we do, we talk specifically about what's going on in the agricultural field. And then we have an educator that's been here a long time. He gives his kind of background about being here in the 80s, and that was a huge farm crisis and getting through that. And then I come in and I talk about the signs, symptoms, resources, and I give them some tips on, you know, what to say to people. What do I say? Someone comes to me, you just have a gut feeling that something's not going right. I give them things that they can go away with in their toolbox if they need them.
And I would imagine you're working with the Michigan Milk Producers Association. You're working with Greenstone Farm Credit, for example, and other organizations that have direct contact with farmers. Working with those people, those are folks that farmers might mention stress or fatigue to that they might not otherwise.
Yep. So we talk a lot about their social circle. And I use my father as an example. He doesn't leave the family farm, right? He milks cows. He takes care of his cows. And so his social circle is the milk hauler that comes to the family farm. And so that's the message that we tell Greenstone or MMPA, that you're probably going to hear those signs, those symptoms, what's going on. So that's, okay, what can I say to them? What fact sheet or something from MSU Extension can I give them to, hey, here's some resources or...
Well, Jeff and Suzanne, you both probably have, we've talked in general terms about some great educational programs that MSU Extension does. What about a couple of specific examples of where your efforts have made a very tangible and profound difference in a farm family?
So, Kirk, I think we have had those examples, and I just wanted to go back to one thing you said, is that part of all of this, too, is that if you think about any of us, whether we're involved in agriculture or not, the two things we're reticent to talk to people about are if we're having financial troubles or if we're having stress or mental health troubles, right? And so that's a really important part of this and a really important part of what Suzanne does in her part of this training that you were referring to is just getting people to have some sense of I need to tell others, but also that others have a sense of this doesn't seem quite right. But one example I would give you, and I know Suzanne has others, is I received an email a couple of months ago from somebody that was in one of these classes with Suzanne and literally went home to find in her living room a concerning situation. It happened to be with an adult child or a teenage child that was worried about a friend. And this individual was just saying, I knew more and had tools and knew what I could do in a way I wouldn't have known the day before.
That was the example I was thinking of too. And the reason why is because it was the very first class I ever did. So it just, tugged at the heartstrings, like, wow, this is important work. But we've had lots of comments, lots of emails, lots of thanks. Hopefully, I've taught regular CPR for many years. Hopefully you never have to use it. But if you have the tools that you can go out and if for some reason you need it, I'm glad that they have the tools in their toolbox.
CPR is an excellent analogy. Suzanne, for people listening to this program, where can they go for more information? I know you've got some great educational materials online with MSU Extension. Maybe they can just Google MSU Extension and stress management, but other places.
Well, they can go to our website, and that's at msue.anr.msu.edu/managing-farm-stress. So we have a specific website with all these resources and tips and tools that they can get right online.
Well, things are going to stay tough for a while by all indications, so this is very important work for the agricultural community. I congratulate you, Suzanne, on the workshops and the training that you're doing, and congratulate MSU Extension on the fine work that they're doing to meet these challenges. I've been talking with Dr. Jeff Dwyer, who is the director of MSU Extension, and Suzanne Pisch, an MSU Extension educator who focuses on social and emotional health and well-being. Thank you both.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you for having us in.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, coming up on March 4th on the MSU campus is a wonderful environmental and conservation event which focuses on quiet water. It is the 22nd annual Quiet Water Symposium, and with me are Gary and Linda DeCock, members of the planning committee, and as you might imagine, ardent canoeists and kayakers. Gary and Linda, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you.
The Quiet Water Symposium, Gary, let's start with you. Before we get into the symposium, some of our listeners may not be familiar with the term quiet water. What are we talking about?
We're talking about non-motorized outdoor recreation. And the paddle sports falls under that. So we're talking about canoeing, kayaking, stand-up paddle boards, things that get you out on the water here in the Great Lakes State.
And the Quiet Water Society would be enthusiasts for all of those things and probably more.
We're the nonprofit that puts on this event, so we provide the volunteers and the committee that does the organizing.
Okay, so the 22nd annual Quiet Water Symposium on the campus of Michigan State, March 4th. Tell us about some of the things that folks can expect if they go.
We have the exhibit floor booked with over 150 exhibitors. There are 222 spaces. Those will all be filled up. These will be demonstrations of paddle sport, hiking, cycling, and a lot of the other outdoor activities that get us outside.
Now, you will hold this at the MSU Pavilion, the Livestock Pavilion. I've been there many, many times. A lot of room for exhibitors, but how many exhibitors can we expect to see?
We've got 152 exhibitors. We just sold out yesterday. Last one just signed up yesterday afternoon, so we now have a waiting list for participating in the exhibition.
Now, this year there is an emphasis, and we'll get to the speakers in a second, but an overall emphasis on safety. Why safety this year?
We had some reports circulating from the Great Lakes Coast Guard about incidents this summer where there were drownings on the Great Lakes. And so we took that quite seriously, and we decided that we would step forward and make that a focus this year with our speakers so we can try to share some safety information, and hopefully people will take home some lessons.
Now, Linda, you've lined up the speakers for the Quiet Water Symposium. They're going to emphasize safety in their remarks, but tell us a little bit about your featured speakers.
I'd love to. This has been so much fun. We have, I think, an amazing slate of speakers. We have a lot of people from Michigan talking about Midwest destinations for not only kayaking and canoeing, but also cycling and hiking and backpacking, so we're not limiting ourselves to water sports. But we also have speakers who have been around the world. We have a woman from Lansing who has been paddling in Zambia, which is really fun. We have Kevin Callan, who's from Canada and is a top name in canoeing, who's going to be talking about the whiskey tour on the Spey River in Scotland. We have Gary and Joni McGuffin from up in Ontario who are doing just amazing things in terms of water trails. We have everything from beginners sessions on paddling to expert sessions on paddling. So it's not only where you can go, it's how you can do it and why you should do it, why it's important to be outside.
So if you're fairly novice at the paddling recreational activities, then you don't need to be intimidated by all of these veteran, experienced canoeists and kayakers.
Absolutely not. This is where you come to learn. And even if you're not a paddler, it's fun just to come and watch the slideshows. If you're interested in travel, you can just sit back and enjoy yourself.
A couple other speakers that are mentioned in your program, Cliff Jacobson and Hap Wilson, have already made some comments on your website relative to this safety issue. You are really, as Gary mentioned, really underscoring the importance of safety during these activities. A lot of people may not know that it can be dangerous if you're not careful.
That's absolutely right. A lot of people will go out and buy a little kayak and they'll go out in the water not realizing that it's important to not only have some skills, but to wear your PFD, which is your life jacket, to have an emergency plan, to go with somebody, to let somebody know where you're going to be so that we can avoid the kinds of incidents that we've had in the past year.
I'm talking about the Quiet Water Symposium that will be held Saturday, March 4th at the Michigan State University Pavilion from 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. With me are Gary and Linda DeCock, who are members of the Planning Committee. Gary, you couldn't do this without support from sponsors, and some people have been supportive since the very beginning, including Michigan State University.
Yes, they've been our partners since we started the symposium in 1996. We also have the DNR Parks and Recreation Division that's going to be the show sponsor this year. Very excited about having them as a partner.
I noticed some of your sponsors, and I just have to say this, but a couple of them are brew pubs. And, I'm just making association there. Are Quiet Water enthusiasts also maybe microbrewery enthusiasts from time to time?
I can't speak for everybody else. I know I am. I know Linda is. So we got those bases covered. It's nice to be able to enjoy a good time on the water and after that enjoy a good time with your friends at a local brew pub.
Is there a cost to get into the show, Gary?
Yes, it's $10 for adults, $5 for students with ID, 12 and under is free, scouts and uniforms are free. We'll do anything to try to get young people into the show and get them enthused about getting outdoors here in Michigan.
And I'm familiar with the Michigan State University pavilion, but parking is generally very easy on folks who attend any events at that wonderful facility.
We've got parking right next to the pavilion, but we've also got overflow parking, and we will have a shuttle service that will give people rides back and forth to their car all day.
Well, it's going to be a wonderful event. The symposium is in its 22nd year, but I've also got to mention as we close out the interview, you two put your paddles where your mouths are, and you've done many trips by canoe and kayak, but this summer you both are planning a long trip from a small lake in the Upper Peninsula to Chicago. Tell us a little bit about that, Linda.
We're calling it the Five River Voyage, and we plan on paddling the entire Wisconsin River, the entire Illinois River, 500 miles back on our beloved Mississippi. We love paddling the Mississippi. And then we'll end up in Chicago. And we're doing it as a fundraiser for an organization called Water for People. It's out of Denver, but the CEO is from Michigan. Water for People does amazing things in 9 countries to bring water and sanitation to people who don't have it.
Well, maybe a bit ahead of that trip, we can have you both back to talk a little bit about some of the details, but congratulations, and I need to learn a little bit more about the group Water for People, and I'm going to do that ahead of that interview. Gary, anything else about the symposium that you'd like folks to know?
I mentioned that we have 162 exhibitors. A number of those will be doing demonstrations throughout the day. For example, Alan Deming from Mackinac Watercraft will be doing a demonstration on how to build your own boat. So a lot of our focus has been how to do it yourself, how to build it yourself, and make this into a lifelong hobby.
Okay, again, the symposium, the Quiet Water Symposium, Saturday, March 4th at the Michigan State University Pavilion from 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. I've been talking with Gary and Linda DeCock, who are members of the planning committee, and again, in their own right, ardent quiet water enthusiasts. Gary and Linda, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association, with another observation from The Spartan Life. Jim Tooman is a world-renowned motivational speaker, philosopher, and personal coach who has touched more than 2 million lives with his powerful message of self-acceptance, tolerance, and hope. So you can imagine my excitement at the prospect of meeting this exceptional Michigan State University alumnus at our Alumni Association Grand Awards celebration. Jim turned out to be just what I expected. A humble guy who was much more interested in talking about me than talking about himself. He was gracious. His remarks were inspiring. He hung around until the last guest had left. And this week, he sent me a thank you note. It's entitled, On This Day, and it's perfect for this week's message. On this day, mend a quarrel. Search out a forgotten friend. Dismiss a suspicion and replace it with trust. Write a letter to someone who misses you. Encourage a youth who has lost faith. Keep a promise. Forget an old grudge. Examine demands on others and vow to reduce them. Fight for a principle. Express your gratitude. Overcome an old fear. Take 2 minutes to appreciate the beauty of nature. Tell someone you love them. Tell them again and again and again. Jim concluded this with, thank you for touching my life. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all of these things Jim Tooman suggests are within your reach. Try modeling this behavior for a week and watch what happens. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans AD Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR. For listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear the show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.